other things like that can do a lot of good by changing will require more public health. I think it was Mike's slide that talked about behavioral health changes and how important that is for some 40% of chronic disease. Increasingly, that's something we're going to have to try and pull back into the main spectrum. We find often at state levels, as those of you who work with states know, many of the people who need to be together to coordinate across a state spectrum of services and healthcare often don't know each other and certainly don't gather together very often. So we have a coordination of care not just among providers, but coordination among state officials who work with these public programs. A bit about what we're trying to do, a little more specifically, just to give you a sense of where states are certainly interested in making changes, whether they can accomplish it or not. Of course, the federal level, there's always an agenda. We, in fact, just appointed, got together a what we're calling Medicaid Task Force, but we're now calling it Task Force for Health Sustainability.
Healthcare Sustainability.
I'm looking at Mike because his governor, as well as the governor Haslam, are co-chairing the task force. And it has large and small states, so California and New York are both members of this task force, along with others. And we hope to begin modestly, but looking at waiver processes and how they can be reformed to make it much more transparent to states who apply, make it perhaps more timely, making it more obvious as to what the outcome might be. As Mike said, we have states who are willing to mimic, if not copy, Oregon, but it's not clear that they would get a waiver as Oregon did because of the uncertainty of the outcome of the promise. So we need more clarity as to what is will be found to be in good stead and what won't. We'll also be doing more work on dual eligibles. We know that they've been slow in coming out of Melody Bella's shop because of complications inside CMS, because of fights over who gets what share of what savings. Lots of things that are kind of at the margin, if you will, I'm thinking about the larger issue of delivering care to duals. So we're hoping that this group of governors can be constructive in the saying to CMS writ large, we're happy to develop a formula for sharing, but let's go on with the business of taking care of the duals and not argue over how much savings is going to Medicare and Medicaid. And then if we can, I hope I'm not overly naive about this, but I'm hopeful we can also get to a framework for how Medicaid might be reformed. We have obviously lots of different interests here. We don't have agreement on ACA, but I think we can get close to agreement on Medicaid and how better to implement it, how much flexibility is necessary, what the state differences are. So we're going to work hard at that in the next 6 months or so and see how far we can get. But we are, in general, trying to help all along the spectrum. As I said, communications, we're experimenting with a basic service that would allow communications to Medicaid participants upon their smartphones to remind them of appointments and pharmacy bills, all the way up to systemic change. We're helping 8 of the design states in the SIM program come together within their state to see what might be done on systemic reform. We have an agreement and we'll have joint sponsorship of NGA and the Institute of Medicine to hold statewide retreats. We'll spend a weekend locked away somewhere within the state where the governor will bring the policy political side of the state and the IOM will bring the medical healthcare delivery side of the state and put 40 people or so in a room and go through what we hope are a series of critical questions for systemic reform within the state. We don't obviously expect to answer those questions, but at least we might find out what the edges are, parameters for change, and what we need to do to facilitate it. So we're trying all along the spectrum to help. Those of you who know the Brenner work, as I mentioned before, we don't know how scalable it is. Jeff's worked pretty much at a local level with a lot of community resources. So we're going to experiment in 5 states to see if we can replicate it and hopefully ultimately scale it up. But we don't know how successful that's going to be. So as I said, our framework of looking at supply and demand, we're encouraging states to increase supply, scope of practice, and other things that they do have some control over, and making the arguments that we hope will be needed and taken in a series of why it's not important to do, why it's safe to do, if you will. We have lots of arguments about dental hygienists, for example. There are 50 million kids last year who didn't get any dental care. We have 40 million people who live in areas of insufficient dental care. And yet we have, of course, these arguments about what can dental hygienists do without the supervision of a dentist and how they can be paid. And if we can resolve those two issues and expand scope, we will almost immediately increase the supply. But also requires us to think about the curriculum and help states figure out what's the most important thing. Is it dental hygienists? Is it a mid-level dental hygienist, if you will, or advanced practice dental hygienist, which some states have approved? What are the capacities in schools to train? How long does it take? What are the capital requirements for setting up an independent dental hygienist office, if that's what we intend to do? We now let dental hygienists go into prisons and nursing homes and practice essentially on their own, but after that, we tend to cut them off. So there's a whole range of issues that need to be resolved in order to work on supply, but that's what we're trying to help states do. As I said, decrease demand by helping particularly the most expensive chronically ill patients reduce their use of hospitals and nursing homes. And we think it can be done. Many of you know, if you look at these data, we have a lot of folks going to emergency rooms that don't need to. And I don't mean by in that sense that they're not ill, but they are. By the time they get to the emergency room, they probably need to be there. But the point is we could prevent that earlier in the disease process, either through prevention or teaching people how better to take care of their chronic illness. My favorite, of course, hobby horse is asthmatic kids who, with an asthma attack, end up, of course, in the emergency room or even checked in the hospital. If you look at some state data, about 80% of those visits are unnecessary because of the prior treatment. We know how to keep these attacks from occurring. We know what the precursors are. We know what the signs are. And so we avoid or fail to give correct medications and activities and end up with these kids back in the emergency room over and over again. The state of Washington, for example, 2 years ago, really focused on trying to reduce that utilization and went from $400 million in asthma attack treatment among the Medicaid population to $40 million. So by a factor of 10, they reduced the cost, but obviously reduced the need for these kids to be in the emergency rooms. There are great possibilities here. So we're, as I said, working on supply, trying to reduce demand. Price transparency is something most states haven't done enough of. We hope to. We're actually collecting a compendium of best practices for contracting for Medicaid first and elder health care second. What are the right requirements for disclosure prices and other things? So along the way, we're trying to get states more active in taking advantage of the tools they have and not waiting or requiring changes in federal law, federal funding, ACA, or other things that we can't quite address. So with that, we'll move on.
Is the sound okay in the back? No? Up?
No.
Okay, I'm going to try it. Thank you.
Good morning. Campus yesterday, and I'm sorry that Stuart isn't, that it's not as nice as Brandeis, but hope you enjoyed it. I'm going to talk about two RWJF programs that are helping states navigate this new world. One that focuses on implementing the ACA, another that focuses on helping states with quality value strategies. And then I'm going to step back and talk a little bit about the lessons we're hearing from state initiatives. So first, the State Health Reform Assistance Network, some of you have heard of it, and we're very pleased to have Oregon be part of the program. We're helping states, really the theory of change in LEND, we're now 11 states actually.
Oh, great.
Yeah, exciting. Helping states develop successful models, and the theory hopefully is that we'll create some momentum that other states can emulate. And we provide technical assistance to states on all the coverage provisions within the ACA. So helping them stand up their exchanges, helping them with the Medicaid expansion, helping them operationalize all the new health insurance reform rules. We have a diverse group of states, which is nice because then we hope that these models will be relevant to other states. As much as we admire what Vermont and Oregon are doing, we know that not every state can achieve that. So we really need to develop different models as you look across the country. I'm also directing a new program that RWJF is funding, which is helping states think about what levers they have to promote quality and value strategies. And we're hoping to leverage relationships from the Aligning Forces for Quality program run by the Robert Johnson Foundation and the State Network program. And we're going to be providing technical assistance to states in three different areas, which really dovetails well with what Dan just laid out, which is how do we help states shape incentives through reforms in payment and purchasing? How do we help them gather and use data better? And how do we help them engage stakeholders? I think we don't want to lose the lesson we heard from Anya and Mike, which is that you have to survive the political process, and to do so, you have to work smartly with stakeholders. As Len mentioned, there's significant funding going out to states in the SIM grants, but the good news is that 25 states are receiving SIM grants. The bad news is that 25 states are not receiving SIM grants. So how do we make sure that that gap between the Vermonts and Oregons of the world and other states doesn't continue to widen? So what are we seeing thus far? As Len mentioned, there are a lot of tools in the toolbox, a lot of opportunities for states to improve quality and value. We're seeing multi-payer coalitions, ACOs. As Mike mentioned, states have different names for them often to differentiate from what the federal reforms are, but states are looking at different forms of ACOs or other kinds of organizations where they can coordinate care better. Seeing a lot of emphasis on the duals. And then I'll focus because more extensively on this bottom one, a lot of interest in reforming data collection and quality metrics. Several states have actually been using the opportunity over the last couple of years to build all payer claims databases. So you had states that had APCDs already, but then several states, New York and Rhode Island in particular, have seen funding opportunities in the ACA to build these APCDs. So I think you're going to see a renewed emphasis on how states collect data and then how they use that data. That's also, of course, in some states will jive with how states use their Medicaid HIEs. So I like to think about it as two buckets. What reforms are happening regardless of the ACA? And then I'll go ahead and talk about where the ACA is the catalyst. So starting first with where Medicaid reforms are happening regardless of the ACA, Alabama is an interesting one to watch. There's a bill on the governor's desk that would create regional care organizations. And he hasn't signed it yet, but we're told that he will sign it. And there will be up to 8 regional care organizations. The state will administer the program through the Medicaid program, but the private RCOs will bear the risk. So Alabama is a state that's not expanding Medicaid, a state that doesn't get a lot of attention for delivery system reforms, but they're going to be trying it out with these RCOs. So that's a state to watch going forward. New Mexico, through their Centennial Care Waiver, which was approved earlier this year, has done a comprehensive coordinated service delivery reform with a real emphasis on personal responsibility and payment performance. So New Mexico is another one to watch to see how, again, outside of the arena of the ACA, reforming Medicaid. New York's gotten more attention. They have their Medicaid redesign has a global cap on the state share of Medicaid spending. And in a clever use of, again, this theory of how do you work with stakeholders, they said to all the stakeholders, the hospitals, the nursing homes, come with us together, let's focus on savings, but if we exceed that state cap, we're going to have to come back together again and look at cutting rates or cutting benefits. So they got everybody in the room and agreed on targeted savings, but they put in this sort of a reverse safety valve saying, if we don't achieve those savings, we're coming back to you. So again, a way to use stakeholders. And then finally, Rhode Island has gotten a lot of attention for their global waiver that was started in 2009. They're renewing it this year and looking at rebalancing long-term care, looking at expanding their medical home models, and looking at different payment reforms. Now, here are some places where ACA has been the catalyst, and Mike talked a lot about the CCO program, and Governor Kitzhaber does a very nice job of talking about how expanding coverage is not enough. We have to do it in a way that's sustainable. And so that's been a theme in several states that are doing the Medicaid expansion. They've been using that expansion as an impetus for system reform. And I want to read from a press release that the governor of Colorado put out when he signed legislation expanding Medicaid. He said, we worked diligently over the past several months to find savings in order to expand coverage. Not $1 from the state's general fund will be used for this expansion, even in 2017 when the federal government begins to reduce its share. So in Colorado, it was very important for the governor to say, we're going to expand Medicaid, it's the right thing to do, but we're going to do it in a sustainable way, and we need to find savings in the program in order to do so. So, you know, and I think that'll be an interesting one to watch. Then we'll jump down to what's particularly interesting, and Len touched on this. Since the Supreme Court said that the Medicaid expansion would be optional, it's given states new leverage with the federal government. And some states have been very happy to use that leverage to flex their muscles. We have probably the foremost expert in premium assistance in the audience, Andy Allison. Len pointed him out. Arkansas is proposing a very, very innovative way to do the Medicaid expansion using